What happens when two bass road warriors spend quality time talking music and life with one of their peers? Bassist, educator, author David C. Gross and bassist and head honcho of KnowYourBassPlayer.com, Tom Semioli, trade eights with the legends of rock, jazz, funk, blues, folk, country, and more. Notes from an Artist, revealing conversations with the legends who've created the soundtrack of our lives. What happens? You're about to find out. It's another episode of Notes from an Artist.
February 9th, the City Winery, 7:30 p.m. And most importantly, the benefit is for Teen Cancer America, which is the Who Cares Foundation's American arm.
Tickets are available at www.citywinery.com. Just go to the New York City City Winery prompt. And we have some fabulous guests returning. Our Emily Duff, Puma Pearl, Ann Husick, Joey Kelly's All-Stars, Chris Barato, Troy Weeks. New guests include Lizzie Edwards of Lizzie and the Makers, Gas Wild, and a band called Soul Kick. So it's going to be a great evening.
So donate, buy tickets. We'll see you then February 9th. We've got the great Mark Myers, journalist, author, raconteur.
What else? Well, first of all, we have to give his full name. It's Mark Jazzwax Myers, and www.jazzwax.com is probably the best jazz news and information website. I think it's an online, it's almost like what Downbeat magazine is to the print world. Mr. Myers has written several good books. One of them is called Why Jazz Happened, which is the social history of jazz. He also wrote Anatomy of a Song, the oral history of 45 iconic hits. And he writes for the Wall Street Journal, not too shabby. His new book, which we discuss in this interview, is Rock Concert, an oral history as told by artists, backstage insiders, and fans who were there.
Hear, hear.
What's interesting about this book is Mark goes decade by decade. He talks about the cities where concerts develop, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Memphis. Talks about the big rock festivals such as Woodstock. Does mention that Bob Dylan invented rock as opposed to rock and roll, and we'll get into that. He does talk about the fact that the Stones 72 tour set the template for the modern rock concert as we know it. He also discusses Live Aid, best 50 live LPs as decided by Mark Myers. And you and I and Mark also got into the future of streaming concerts and hologram concerts. So
fascinating discussion, Tom. The thing that I found most interesting is his take on it. Not even so much the hologram, just the streaming concert with ability to go backstage, the ability to set which cameras you... Oh, it's fascinating. Fascinating. That's towards the end of this interview / musical soiree.
Let's bring on Mark Myers.
There's Mark Myers.
Hey.
Hey, Mark Myers. You know, when David first broached the subject, because we have to interview Mark Myers, he wrote this great book.
See, this is my fault. So if you have anyone to blame at the end of it, it's me.
Or the beginning or the middle. And he said, Mark Myers. I said, who is this guy? I don't know Mark Myers. And then I saw it and I said, wait a second. This is Mark Jazzwax Myers. This is not Mark Myers. This is Mark Jazzwax.
And of many guys.
We were just talking about what we're going to talk to Mark Myers about. And of course, we're going to talk about the oral history of the rock concert. And I said to David, you know, Mark Myers is the Howard Zinn of music journalism. He tells the story from the bottom up. And I know Frank Zappa said rock journalism is people who can't write, interviewing people who can't talk, for people who can't read. It's not the case with Mark Myers' books, Why Jazz Happened, The Anatomy of a Song, which is a fabulous book.
Thank you.
But we're going to get to the bottom of this, David. So let's start. Mark, how did you get interested in music?
How did I get interested in music? I think music was all around me growing up in the 60s, Tom. It was just endless. Couldn't avoid it. Couldn't get around it. By the late 1960s, believe it or not, I felt wasn't connecting really with hard rock when it first came out. And I moved into jazz. It was a lot cooler to walk around high school carrying a saxophone case than a guitar case. So jazz was it for me. And then came back to rock, obviously, in the 2000s when I started to write about it for the Wall Street Journal.
Carrying around a saxophone case, was that your choice of instrument?
Tenor saxophone was the jazz albums that I was picking up, like albums by Sonny Stitt and Gene Ammons. The tenor saxophone was just about as cool as it got.
You just heard two tracks. The first was Sonny Stitt doing Everything Happens to Me, and the last track was Gene Ammons doing Canadian Sunset. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
I didn't spend too much time with it. I think carrying it around was a whole lot more impressive than actually playing it. But, that's high school for you.
Yeah. Well, unlike many journalists who write about music, you actually studied music, which I think is a very big difference, because you know what it's like to be on the bandstand and you know what it's like to the sacrifice and the practice.
To learn any instrument, it's difficult. And to be able to perform on an instrument in a group is even more difficult. I think people just think people are born this way and they're able to play and they're able to improvise and do all the things that they do. As you point out, Tom, it's years and years and years of practice, of jamming, of woodshedding, and making it so that you're not looking down at your feet when you dance, so to speak. It just comes naturally.
Yeah, you're right about that in terms of how people think, oh, you're born with this, born with that. I've been reading a few books lately, you know, on behavior and such, and mine in particular, because...
keep reading it.
You know, exactly. When you think about it, we're all born, we're all open palates. So to actually be good at something, you really do have to practice. I mean, everything from fears to the good things, kindness and stuff, they're all based on continuation and practice. And here we are as virtually old men in some regards. I still practice.
Yeah, I mean, and it's true of writing, it's true of any art, that the more you do it, the harder you work at it, the faster it comes. And there comes a point when suddenly you realize that you can try something new, or you can change the way writing works, or you can change the way music sounds, but you do have to get to a point where it comes so fluidly and comes so intuitively that you're not even thinking about it, that your heart is actually controlling the art, not your brain.
That was the Jimmy Lunceford Orchestra doing "Tain't What You Do, It's the Way That You Do It." This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com. When I started reading your stuff, actually on Facebook, you had so many great records from the past to recommend. I've got one of those album-oriented screensavers.
Right.
And there's a Buddy Freeman record that cuts up. It's Mark Myers. All that great 50s stuff. It's fantastic music. I really think, for want of anything better, we should just do a radio show on that, because you have a ton of great stuff. And
you know what the sad thing? You know the sad thing is, guys, when we were coming up, we had record stores. We had very smart, knowledgeable DJs. There were charts. There were all these things. There were clerks in record stores who knew everything. And today, none of that exists. So people who are coming to jazz and even rock have no sense of the history. They have no sense of perspective of where something fits in. And in some ways, the blogger, especially with jazz, I sort of have replaced either that late night DJ, or in a more pedestrian way, I'm the record clerk in the red vest at Sam Goody, who is hipping somebody to something they don't know. But the blogger really has supplanted and replaced those people who could inform you and educate you and school you in what was worth picking up and why.
Yeah, and the blogger is so very important, but dare we say, is the blogger being replaced by the algorithm in a streaming world? Now, I'm on Spotify. Just to reflect, it is so amazing in the people of our generation in the last 25 years to go on to YouTube and see videos of Miles Davis in Europe, to see Thelonious Monk, to see Weather Report, stuff we never saw on Don Kirshner's Rock Concert or any American television. And all this information is available to us. And the thing about Spotify is, I'll read Jazz Wax Myers and I'll just, in the middle of your paragraph, I go to Spotify and I start dialing up all this stuff. And of course, Spotify now knows my algorithms. The algorithm is now the store clerk, the red vested Sam Goody guy, who's suggesting stuff for me. And I got to tell you, that algorithm does pretty good suggesting new music for me.
It's a little, I guess, electronic horn and hard art, though. You know, it's like, as a Pandora, you want more stuff like Steely Dan. And the next track kind of sounds like Steely Dan. The next 15 have nothing to do with the music whatsoever. So ultimately, I don't think anything replaces somebody suggesting something and passionately explaining why something works. I think the heart, the emotion still connects there. And when you're sort of told about something that you didn't know and you listen to a couple of tracks of it, you know, then you're off to the races. You know, like a Lenny Tristano. I got so many emails from people saying, God, I never heard of this guy, Lenny Tristano, believe it or not. But you write in this post, like, this isn't a good place to start. Where should I start? Because the new box from Mosaic is a little advanced. You know, it's like home recordings and things like that. So all you have to do is put down the crumbs and people will eat it up. They just want to follow it all the way along to its root.
That was the great Lenny Tristano doing Marionette. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com. Regarding Spotify, you take it one step further with YouTube. Now, Tom and I are big music education buffs. I have about 18 books out on how to play bass and stuff like that. I really think it's truly important to learn to read music, music theory. Now, you can go on Spotify and you can have 9 or 10 people teach you how to do it wrong. And it's really extraordinary how, why go back if I can learn Birdland and not have to put the record on over and over again? I can just, oh, that's it in tablature. The hell is tablature? And so it's a new world in terms of that. It really, really is. Now, I remember back in the day, because I grew up on 68th and Broadway, I would go to McHale's. I'd sit as far away from Gordon Edwards, so to speak, across the table from you, basically. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So I would gather the knowledge, go home. The next thing I know, it's 4:30 in the morning. I just finished practice.
This is Notes from an Artist on Cygnus Radio.
There's such an evolution going on. What's great about music and what's horrible about music is the same thing, which is way too much choice today. In other words, you can pick almost any country in Africa and explore that music through YouTube right. And through other means online without paying a dime. And right. The problem is, like with the news, you have enormous, enormous amounts of choice, but you don't know which one to trust. There's so much out there, and there's so much in the past, and there's so much happening now, and there's so much worldwide that one tends to then listen to the same things over and over again because there's just not enough time in the day to figure out what's happening in Scottish rock or what's happening, you know, bossa nova in Rio. Are there any clubs still playing it down there? Are there artists down there doing it still? So it just takes too much time and there's too much choice. And I think that's where we come in, so to speak, the arbiters, the tastemakers. In some ways, we're not that different from Anthony Bourdain. We are, because we're here, but it's not that different in terms of him turning us on right. to places we can't go, but not just turning us on to places we can't go, but telling us why something tastes so great or why right. this is the best of this kind of dish he's ever had. That's now our job to do that with music.
Yeah, and again, I echo that Jazzwax does it. It's almost like reading Gary Giddens, though, who I'm sure you're a fan of. If you read a Gary sure. Giddens book, that's a college course in jazz education, and as is Jazzwax, both entertaining, informative, yeah. and educating. And your book, Rock Concert, comes at a very interesting time. David and I recently interviewed in the last couple of months Larry Grenadier, Colin Blunstone, and a bass player by the name of Ron Carter. Yeah, you might have heard of him. He played on a few records, right, David? Yeah. We were talking about the streaming concert now because of COVID, which isn't going to go away soon, and it's still going to affect the way we live out the rest of our lives. Larry did this wonderful streaming concert. I don't know if you saw it. It was from the Village Vanguard. He had released a solo bass album called The Gleaner, and he did a solo bass performance from the Village Vanguard. It was beautifully lit. The sound was wonderful, and I think, David, the ticket pricing started
$10, believe it or not.
$10 donation, and you can watch an evening with Larry Grenadier. We spoke with Colin Blunstone and Rod Argent of the Zombies, and they had done a streaming concert. Well, it was a preview to this from Abbey Road. And of course, again, because they can't tour right now because of COVID, and they did it and they brought in an orchestra so they could do some of the Odyssey and Oracle stuff, which you can't quite do on the road. It's not cost effective, et cetera. And the venues just aren't there anymore. So we're seeing a change of perception of what the concert is. Ron Carter's old school. He just says, no, you got to play live. But given COVID, given the new technology, which we're using right now, Zoom, it looks like the rock concert is going to morph into something different than just all these people being together in one place.
It has to. I mean, even if the live concert comes back, companies are now busy figuring out how to monetize streaming concerts. I think maybe happening is take the Stones. If you want to see the Stones live, you'll pay $350, right? Cool. And if you want to see them at home on your large computer screen or television, well, maybe it's $75. And then let's say it's $75, but you can control 7 cameras. You can function like the producer. You can click on something that gives you the close-up of Mick Jagger. Or now you want to look at the drummer. Or now you want an overhead look. You know, you want a drone view of the arena or stadium. For an extra $25 or $30, maybe it's $125, you go backstage and somebody's interviewing Keith, and you're in the room with Keith, and he's talking to you on the cast. So there's a lot of flexibility. There's a lot of exploitation that can take place here. So even if the live concert comes back,
right,
I can't see streaming going away. It's only going to become more sophisticated. It's only going to become greater and better. And we just have to hope that the bands that are performing are good.
That was the Rolling Stones live on their Steel Wheels tour doing Mixed Emotions. As a matter of fact, both Tom and I were at that Shea Stadium concert. It was 1989. A great show, a great band. This is Notes from an Artist on Cygnus Radio.
You mentioned in the book many threats to live music. When the player piano came out, people thought, oh, well, gosh, they won't go to concerts. When the phono cylinder came about, oh, that's it. It's going to kill interest in live concerts. But as you point out, it actually enhanced public interest in seeing live music, as did radio. Radio was going to kill the radio star. MTV came along, and that enhanced people wanting to see live music. YouTube.
Well, that's a debatable subject, whether it enhanced or not.
Well, YouTube and Spotify came along, but nothing will ever kill people wanting to hear live music.
Well, here's part of the reason why. There's only two types of megastars in this country. One is the movie star, and the other is the music star. And most people have never seen a movie star. I mean, you see them on TV. You very rarely, you know, sometimes maybe you'll see them in a restaurant, but you won't disturb them at their table. Or maybe you see them walking on the beach someplace, but you rarely ever. Most people never, ever see a movie star. And right, movie stars don't go to Madison Square Garden and read from a script to 55,000 people. It's just not right. Interesting. Nobody would go and pay. It's just boring. Right. But a music star is different because one has an intimate relationship with the music that they're listening to. One has an intimate relationship with an album. A lot of times albums help you through, especially if you're young, help you through anxieties, help you through school problems, help you through bullying, help you through being different. Suddenly you can go to someplace and not only hear the music that you love, but you can actually see the star who recorded it and sang it and you feel you have a relationship with. That is always going to be a big magnetic draw.
That was Rock Show by Paul McCartney and Wings. This is Notes from an Artist on Cygnus Radio.
One of the things that I love about rock concert is all the stories, all the people you interviewed. Let me just read Mike Stoller, Tommy La Puma, Wanda Jackson, who talked about the importance of looking the part, George Wein, Peter Yarrow, Joan Baez, Paul Stuckey, Joe Boyd, Ronnie Spector, Tony Barrow, Bob Eubank, Henry Diltz, Michael McClure, Steve Miller, who had some harsh words about the Who destroying their instruments. Why did you choose these people to tell these stories?
First of all, I'm always curious as to how this thing called the rock concert went from an auditorium where boxing and wrestling was held right. In 1950 to a multi-billion dollar industry today. I was very curious about the evolution because the rock concert doesn't really have corporate involvement until the much later stages of the right. Rock concert. It's largely entrepreneurs and it's young entrepreneurs and it's a Wild West marketplace of the right. Rock concert. But I didn't want to tell this story through the usual suspects and people you expect to hear from. At each stage, I wanted people who are eyewitnesses, but unusual eyewitnesses. So in my chapter on the rise of Elvis in Memphis, I just went to three women. You know, I went to Wanda Jackson. I went to Kay Wheeler, his first fan club president. And right. I went to Barbara Hearn, his first girlfriend. And through women, I mean, Elvis was a female experience for the most part. I wanted to sort of not only get the female perspective on Elvis as he was coming up in 56, 55 and 56, but also I wanted the view from the side of the stage. I wanted the view from the wings because each of them watched this guy come out, watched him go on stage, watched him come off stage and saw him in the dressing room. And at each phase, from the dressing room to the walk to the stage to being on stage and coming back with three different people. And that was fascinating, getting that through these three women.
That was the Ed Sullivan Show on Sunday, October 28th, 1956. That was Elvis Presley, and you heard him doing Hound Dog. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
Just some of the reflections in this book touch upon, like, would Woodstock have been forgotten if it wasn't on film?
It would have been. And the other fascinating thing about Woodstock is it's astonishing there wasn't a stampede. It's astonishing there wasn't a crush of people. It's astonishing there weren't fights and pushing and shoving. The promoters took a number of steps, which I thought was interesting, to limit that. First, they promoted this as a peace and love event right. So that people wouldn't bring their political baggage and their protests to it.
Right.
So it was constantly a peace and love event. So when people showed up, they were showing up basically to get stoned, lie on their back, you know, in the grass and just listen to music. They didn't realize it was going to rain for most of the time, but it was a peace and love event.
That was Joe Cocker and Mad Dogs an Englishman when they were playing live at Woodstock 1969 in August. That was with a little help from my friends. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
David, let's talk about what's going to happen February 9th, 7:30 p.m. at the City Winery in New York City. It is going to be our second Notes from an Artist Teen Cancer America benefit. Our first benefit was a tribute to the Beatles album Let It Be and the Get Back documentary. This one, David, what did we choose?
We chose Beggar's Banquet. Basically, come back to the roots, Rolling Stones record.
One of the reasons why we chose Beggar's Banquet, because of the similarities between Get Back, Let It Be, and Beggar's Banquet. So for the continuity of our performances, both records came out around the same time, late 68, 69. The Beatles saw Jean-Luc Godard's film, Sympathy for the Devil, and perhaps they got the idea to film themselves making an album. Sympathy for the Devil, Beggar's Banquet, concluded with the rock and roll circus that was shelved. Get Back concluded with the Let It Be album and film that was shelved. Glyn Johns worked on both Get Back and Beggar's Banquet. Lindsay Michael Hogg produced both Let It Be and the Rock and Roll Circus. We see lots of copies of Better News Banquet in the Get Back special. And John Lennon and Bill Wyman both wore the same clothes for cinematic continuity.
February 9th, the City Winery, 7:30 p.m. And most importantly, the benefit is for Teen Cancer America, which is the Who Cares Foundation's American arm.
Tickets are available at www.citywinery.com. Just go to the New York City City Winery prompt. And we have some fabulous guests returning are Emily Duff, Puma Pearl, Ann Husick, Joey Kelly's All-Stars, Chris Barato, Troy Weeks. New guests include Lizzie Edwards of Lizzie and the Makers, Gas Wild, and a band called Soul Kick. So it's going to be a great evening.
So donate, buy tickets. We'll see you then February 9th.
I was also surprised, I didn't know this until I did the interviewing, that there was a moment there toward the end of the concert as 400,000 people were sort of getting ready to hear the last groups that the governor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller, had called one of the promoters and said, we're sending in 10,000 National Guard troops to help people get out of there. And the promoter said, you can't do that. And the governor said, what's the problem? I mean, this thing could get out of hand. These people are all going to want to leave at the same time. They said, if you send National Guard, there's going to be rioting against the guard. These people who came for peace and love are going to get violent and there's going to be tear gas. And do you really want those photos on the cover right. of the newspaper the next day? Or do you just want to have a photo of peace and love the next day? And fortunately, the governor backed off and decided not to send in those troops. Had he sent in 10,000 National Guard to, quote, help people get out of there, somebody along the way was going to throw something at these guys sure. and it was going to start trouble.
That was Crosby, Stills, and Nash doing a Joni Mitchell song called Woodstock. And for those of you don't know, Joni's management decided not to have her play there. This is Notes from an Artist at CygnusRadio.com.
There's a lot of that happens. Woodstock does change the concert landscape, and of course, Altamont really puts the nail on it.
Right, it does. And it just getting back to Woodstock, it's interesting. Henry Diltz mentioned that Hendrix reclaimed the Star Spangled Banner as a song for the people instead of a military song.
That was such a great story.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that he had been listening to that with his roommate for days, and the reinterpretation of that, because as Diltz, you know, says on that very last day, I mean, most people will think Woodstock lasted 3 days because those are the dates that are always on the poster. Actually right. lasted four because right. it went into the morning about midday on Monday. And the last performer, of course, is Hendrix playing the Star Spangled Banner, and Diltz reflects and sort of says, he said, what the hell are you playing that for? I mean, he's saying this to himself. It's like, that's the man's music. That's the establishment's
right.
theme song. Why are you playing that here? And then about a minute in, he's suddenly realizing what's Hendrix is doing to it, which, as you point out, Tom, he's basically reclaiming it for the 400,000 who are there, basically saying, this is our song too, but we don't sing it this way. We don't play it the same way. We play it a little different. We play it like this.
That was Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock doing the Star Spangled Banner. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
That one reflection at the sort of, as the smoke is clearing in the mist there the next day on Monday, the final day of Woodstock, to have those reflections from Diltz or even Chris Stein,
yes.
you know, going to Port Authority as watching some girl get up on her boyfriend's shoulders and lighting a match to the sprinkler system and soaking everybody. There's just so many of these wonderful tidbits yes. in the book, Rock Concert. They're like little world wonders that you have to have a map or somebody has to give you directions to. You won't find it on the Rock Book Highway. And You won't even find it on the side road. You kind of have to go off onto these little rural routes until I found these stories on the rural routes of this evolution.
Yeah, well, that's why I say it's the people's history of rock concerts. And isn't it interesting now that Hendrix's Star Spangled Banner is played at the Super Bowl and sports games? It's part of the mainstream.
The rock concert changed our culture. Yeah. I mean, keep in mind, before 1955, the music industry could care less what kids thought about music. They weren't marketing to kids at all. I mean, if you were a kid in 1951 and you were interested in music, you would go to the radio and listen to mom's Patti Page favorites. Right. Or, you'd listen to Frankie Lane or dad's music. I mean, the music was made for adults and they were the only ones who could afford the phonograph and records. Kids couldn't afford that stuff. So the music industry wasn't catering to them. It's not until 1955 with the rise of rock and roll and Alan Freed and DJs where the music industry is suddenly catering to teens. In addition, music is being created with lyrics for teens. So Chuck Berry's singing about high school. It's about breakups. It's about drag racing. It's about, things that teens were doing, and suddenly teens are given a voice.
That was No Particular Place to Go by Chuck Berry. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
And the rock concert helps foster that and continues to promote that, and the youth culture becomes the culture, and that's why the Star Spangled Banner by Jimi Hendrix is played at mainstream places now.
It's pretty amazing, yeah. David, you were going to say?
What I was thinking, going back to 1955, so much of the quote-unquote rock music was played at either a school auditorium or maybe a theater or something. So I remember my very first show was at the Steel Pier in
Atlantic City.
My uncle was a health officer for Ventnor, and I went to see Mitch Ryder. I must have been like 9 or 10.
Wow.
So you're already seeing, outside of that Wonder Horse that would jump off the, the diving
board. That's right.
In Atlantic City, you're seeing music come in.
That was Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels doing Jenny Take a Ride. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
Where everyone thinks of Woodstock as the big to-do, it really was Monterey Pop, which was a couple of years earlier. That was the first real big event. Don't you agree?
Yeah, Monterey Pop was the first, let's call it the first, and this is June 6th of 1967. It's the first organized concert, but keep in mind there were folding chairs set up for everybody there. And, you get a lot of the heavy-duty rock artists as well as pop artists on stage there. But again, that also was documented by D.A. Pennebaker. I don't know if it would have been that big a deal without D.A. Pennebaker's film a couple of years later. So to Tom's point, Woodstock would have been some sort of a crowded event upstate, but it never would have been the cultural touchstone, the iconic event that it was, if it wasn't not only for the movie, which, by the way, won an Oscar, the documentary Woodstock, as well as the two. One was a double album, and I believe part two of that was a triple album, as I recall. And everybody wished they had gone who got those albums. Everybody saw people in embrace under a blanket, a guy and a girl hugging each other under a blanket. It was the ethos of the time captured in film and on album covers. And it became really what people felt was how music should be heard, which is out in the open.
Yeah. Now reflect upon what happened to Woodstock in 1999.
Somebody once said, never try to repeat a great event twice because you only wind up comparing one and the other. They both don't wind up being great. One winds up being better than the other. And all you do is talk about the flaws of the one that wasn't as great. Really, what sends rock indoors is Altamont. Is what happens 3 months later in December of 1969. Woodstock is in August, of course, of 69. And by December, you've got Altamont. And what's interesting about Altamont and what came out in the book, in the interview, which I had never known this before either. I never read this anywhere. When the Stones finished, they quickly made it to the cyclone fence and under the fence to that waiting helicopter. The problem is when everybody got on the helicopter, it turned out, and this came from the photographer who was on the helicopter.
Right.
There were too many people on that helicopter, and that helicopter with the Stones and the photographer and whoever else was on there just cleared the mountain. the hill,
right,
heading
that's right,
to San Francisco Airport. If it had been raining, if it had been a problem, if there was one more person who begged to get on, you wouldn't know who the Rolling Stones are today.
Yeah, all right. That's a fascinating story in the book.
The Rolling Stones at Altamont, 1969, December, just 4 months after Woodstock. And that was Sympathy for the Devil. This is Notes from an Artist at CygnusRadio.com.
Another thing you mentioned also on the topic of the Stones, you cite them as the inventor of, for lack of a better word, of the modern day rock concert, that 69 tour. Why was that tour different, the Get Your Ya-Ya's Out tour? That seems to be where the modern rock concert pretty much uses as a template now, because it's pretty much still the same.
Yeah, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I said the 72 tour.
Was that okay?
Yeah, which is the Madison Square Garden. You know, it's when rock goes indoors. Rock has to go indoors, because after Altamont, after the murder of the guy. Meredith at, you know, toward the front, the Hell's Angels beat him to death, or stabbed him to death, I think.
That was from the 1972 Madison Square Garden show at the Garden with the Rolling Stones. That was Keith Richards on lead singing Happy. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I mean, after that, communities won't grant licenses to large events anymore. They just won't, because, and they start setting these incredible standards for any event that does want to take place, because you can't prohibit people from gathering. But you can say you need 100, and, you know, per 1,000 people, you need 25 porta-sands. You need X number of gallons of water. You need X number of doctors. You need, so they set all these standards for take away the risk liability, and the outdoor concert, the wild and free outdoor concert ended. And rock found a home indoors at sports arenas, largely because these sports arenas going up, thanks to urban renewal, a lot of these arenas needed the revenue because their teams were on the road, and suddenly they had this cavernous space, and in they went. But the 72 tour, I mean, Led Zeppelin 69 tour, it's an indoor concert. It's an arena concert.
Sure.
But when the Stones start, they start applying branding, and they start applying all of that Stones stuff to their 72 tour, including their own jet. And they start raising the ante and start turning the rock concert into a real rock star concert. It does change the dynamic, and it does change the feeling of those concerts.
Yeah. And I guess if you cite 72 is the beginning of the modern rock concert, or the rock concert as we know it. Wasn't 75 when they got their first endorsement, Jovan? They sponsored the 75 Stones tour. So now you have corporate sponsorship in rock concerts, which changes the entire dynamic.
Yeah, and as I write in the book, I mean, the real turning point with the Stones, what makes them stand out, is their genius for creating a brand. In other words, the lips and tongue logo, you didn't have to write Rolling Stones anymore. All you needed was that sticker. All you needed to see was that thing slapped on the side of a plane, and you knew exactly who was on the plane. So the notion that you needed to brand yourself, that you needed something, and how that comes to be is another fascinating story from Marshall Chess, whose father was Leonard Chess, and, you know, Phil and Leonard Chess founded Chess Records. He was there. He's in the Netherlands and comes, you know, pulls into a Shell station and realizes the Shell sign is very different than it is in the States. It's yellow and says Shell on it. Over there, it was just yellow thing. And he came to realize that you didn't need to write anything on the Shell gas station sign. All you needed was that yellow shell-shaped figure lit up, and people of any language, you know, no matter what language you spoke, knew exactly what it was. And he came back and said, we got to do this for the Stones. We got to create something that says Rolling Stones without having to write it out. So that's the beginning of once you see the beginning of branding by rock artists, things really start to take a marketing promotion company spin.
John Varados, Varados.com. They're selling $118 Pink Floyd shirt.
The wall, yeah, I saw that. Of course, if you go onto eBay, that same shirt is $11 from the UK.
That was Pink Floyd doing money. Perfect for the branding of a band. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
John Varvatos was brilliant because he, having interviewed him, not for the book, but having interviewed him for the Wall Street Journal, he grew up in the Midwest. I mean, he grew up with the MC5, the Stooges, you know, all that stuff in Detroit. He knew that rock was more than rock, and what hadn't been exploited in rock was rock fashion, to make rock fashion for the masses.
That was Detroit's own MC5 doing Kick Out the Jams. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
You talk about rock fashion. You educate me that the rock T-shirt David started at the Fillmore. At the Fillmore, right? That's what the security guards wore Fillmore
the
shirts.
They wore football jerseys at
football
first.
Football jerseys, right.
Because they want security at concerts used to wear orange. And it's because that it allowed each of them to know who was a security guy and who wasn't. If they're in a crowd and they're pushing and shoving and they're grabbing at that stoned person who's causing all the trouble, and they suddenly grab one of their own and start beating one of their own up, that wasn't a good look for them. So
who may be stoned as well.
Correct. Exactly. So by wearing orange, they knew immediately who was who were the security and who wasn't. The problem was that the orange started to look a lot like prison jerseys. And at the Fillmore, they went to Paragon Sports in New York, and the guy brought 35 green football jerseys. I think it was Packers. Sure. It was either Packers or Jets. I can't remember. I think it was the Packers. It was a green jersey with a number on it. Dressed all the security in those green football tops, primarily so that it would take the hostility out of the audience, would take the edge off, that the audience wasn't being babysat by security guys who were going to beat people up, that it was just people like them who were working as security guards, and it was a more civilized and a quieter interaction between fan and security. But yes, the t-shirt, to be honest with you, if you go back to the Beatles at Shea, there were sweatshirts and t-shirts, just as there were sweatshirts for WINS Good Guys, yellow sweatshirt with the black on it. So using the shirt.
That's WMCA.
Sweatshirt.
Was that WMCA?
Correct.
WMCA.
Good Guys. Yeah, correct. Sorry, you're absolutely right. MCA.
I have one. My sister actually won it at a call-in.
Get that thing on eBay. I mean, I went on eBay recently and looked at one of those WMCA Good Guys sweatshirts, and one was going for like $6.50.
Jack Nitzsche at the piano, and that's his orchestra with Rumble, our sure shot this week. 8 minutes past 9 o'clock on WMCA. What a beautiful day today. A real good guy Thursday, October the 10th. Temperature's 50 degrees at this hour. Humidity 77%. Wind from the north at 5. We'll have a high about 70. Tomorrow even warmer, 75. Sunny both days. Traffic tapering off very nicely now. It's been an unusually busy Thursday morning. George Washington Bridge has been okay all day. Still is. Lincoln Tunnel fine. Holland Tunnel still a little bit sticky in spots. Now remember, alternate side of the street parking regulations are suspended today, tomorrow, and Saturday. This is the second week of the Jewish holidays, the end of Sukkot, and today, tomorrow, and Saturday, the alternate side of the street parking regulations are suspended, but all other parking rules in effect, including the meters. So don't neglect to put the dime in the meters, or Wagner's going to give you a free green ticket, okay? 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. Life begins at 57, Radio 57, WMCA. Oh, a little poem you might like. The experienced babysitter, by practice, can hit on which children to sit with and which ones to sit on.
You?
What, baby?
I have a little poem I'd like to recite.
No, come on, don't be mean. All right, but make it snappy now. Hurry.
Roses are red and violets are blue.
Yeah.
I saw them on the line, and that's how I knew.
WMCA. It's the home of the hits, the home of the good guys. You're gonna be, I'm gonna be singing with the good guys. We wanna be, they wanna be swinging with the good guys. WMCA, WMCA,
here's Big Vacation News.
That was a real blast from the past. That's from the early 1960s. That was the call tag, WMCA, which was 570 on the radio dial. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
Wow. You also mentioned FM radio's role in the evolution of the rock concert. And, of course, growing up on FM radio, you heard everything from Miles Davis to Pink Floyd in one set. But you also quote Bill Graham in the book, don't give them what they want, give them what they should want. The importance of how you had concert curators like Bill Graham, who would put Miles and Steve Miller and Pink Floyd on one bill.
The best clothing store. stores. For instance, the former Barney's. The reason Barney's was special was because it was well, I mean, fashion people use this term, women use this term. It was well edited, okay. Meaning the person, the buyer doing the choosing of which designers and what they were going to actually put in the store were extremely sophisticated and cool. And those were choices. Graham was like that with music. He would put, you know, B.B. King on with Led Zeppelin, right. So that you knew this is where it came from. And this is how these guys from England are interpreting this guy's music. He was interested in the history and he wanted to turn the audience on almost like a DJ, an FM yes. DJ, a good FM DJ.
That was B.B. King doing Rock Me Baby, 1964. And just a few years later, 1968, Led Zeppelin, Good Times, Bad Times. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
February 9th, the City Winery, 7:30 p.m. And most importantly, the benefit is for Teen Cancer America, which is the Who Cares Foundation's American arm.
Tickets are available at www.citywinery.com. Just go to the New York City City Winery prompt. And we have some fabulous guests returning. Our Emily Duff, Puma Pearl, Ann Husick, Joey Kelly's All-Stars, Chris Barato, Troy Weeks. New guests include Lizzie Edwards of Lizzie and the Makers, Gas Wild, and a band called Soul Kicks. It's going to be a great evening.
So, donate, buy tickets. We'll see you then, February 9th.
So we're going to stop it right there because there is so much more to tell. We're going to do a part two the week after next. Next week, of course, is our benefit. So the following week, February 14th, will be part two, Mark Myers. So you guys have a good week. Hope to see you at the benefit. This is David Gross for Tom Semioli and Mark Myers. Bye now.
Thank you.